Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hey, everybody, Patrick here. Recently, I've been getting a lot of questions on the economic fallout of pandemics. And because of that, I want to revisit an older episode from our back catalog, Europe After the Black Death. So let's talk about how the Black Death, the changing climate, and war worked together to create a transitional world and how that laid the foundations for what came after. Thanks for joining me today, and enjoy the show. Horses' hooves clop faintly down a rough gravel road. An icy wind howls. It drowns out most of the sounds of the surrounding countryside. There's a man with the horses, driving a cart. He's wrapped up tight in a thick woolen scarf against the cold. He's transporting barrels of ale. Weather like this might freeze the ale solid, he thinks. He gives the ale a glance in the back of the cart and settles back against the cold. It's late April of the year 1440. April's late for a harsh north wind like this one, but over the last few years, it's gotten more and more common. The winters are longer than they used to be, the carter thinks. The summers aren't nearly as nice. The harvests are worse. His old dad told him the same before he died a few years back. As the horses trek slowly toward the nearby market town, the cart passes through a series of pastures. Skinny sheep and sedate cows look up from the grass they're eating. They watch the horses and the carter as they pass, the peaceful guardians of the field. The carter notices the ruined walls of a dozen or so cottages sticking up amid the livestock. There was a village here about a century ago. It's not the first ruined, deserted village the carter has passed on his journey. The countryside seems full of these ruins, like memories of a half-forgotten landscape. Past the village, a new forest has taken root. The land's thin, it's a bit rocky, but it was once used for growing grain. People were thick on the ground here 100 years ago. They needed that much grain to feed so many people. But today, the land's better used for pasture or for young forests like this one. Wood for fuel and wild game are something people can actually use. It wasn't that long ago that anyone needed that much grain. It wasn't that long ago that this land was full of people, bustling markets, thriving little villages and towns. But now it's just quiet. It was the plague that did it. The carter knows the plague well. That's what took his old dad a few years ago. The plague returns every now and again to wreak havoc on the English countryside and make sure nobody's sleeping too well. The first great outbreak of plague, the Black Death, emptied out this once crowded countryside. Between 1347 and 1351, it helped to set in motion a deep transformation of European society. The carter doesn't know that, at least not in all the details. But he's living in the world the plague created. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thank you for joining me today. The wave of bubonic plague that struck Europe and the Middle East between 1347 and 1351 killed tens of millions of people. This Black Death was a transformative event. It accelerated some processes that were already in motion. It was the direct cause of others. In conjunction with a worsening climate, a deteriorating economy, and a wave of increasingly destructive wars, the Black Death inaugurated a new era. To borrow a term from the historian Bruce Campbell, we can call this period the Great Transition. The Black Death was the central event in this Great Transition. It tipped the balance from a teetering order that had blossomed in the 12th and the 13th centuries to the darker age that followed. The second half of the 14th century and most of the 15th, well, they were hard times. Plague kept coming back. The weather was terrible. The economy was hit or miss. Predatory soldiers fighting one of dozens of different wars, large and small. They burned crops, they destroyed villages, they killed people by the dozens, hundreds, and thousands. Above all, there were just a lot fewer people in this post-plague Europe than there had been in 1300. The Black Death was one of the great disasters in human history. But the key here is that as bad as it wasn't just a singular event. It was part of a larger series of transformations. People couldn't just get over all that and move on with their lives. Along with climate and war, the Black Death marked a basic shift in the foundations of European society. This was just the beginning of a whole new regime of disease, weather, and conflict that set the tone for the next century or more. How Europeans responded to those changing conditions laid the groundwork for the explosion that followed in the late 15th and the 16th centuries. So today, we're going to come to grips with the world the plague made. It's the basic context for and the grim shadow that hangs over everything that followed it. The Hundred Years' War, peasant uprisings, the invention of the printing press, the voyages of discovery, all of those are intimately tied to the Black Death. To try to understand what all that meant in human terms, we're going to follow a peasant family as they navigate the tragedies and possibilities of this new world. So let's start with demography. How many people, living where, under what kinds of conditions, having undergone what kind of change? In last week's episode, I talked a lot about how most of Europe was right on the demographic edge just before the Black Death. Enormous population growth had defined the 200 years between about 1100 and 1300. Population had at least doubled practically everywhere, and in some places there were three or even four times as many people living there. There were a couple of problems with this, though. First, the underlying agricultural technology hadn't changed very much. There was no revolutionary advance like the Green Revolution of the 20th century that allowed for more productive farming to feed all these folks. They just maximized the potential of the existing technology. They maybe improved it a bit, things like windmills, water mills, and so on. More importantly, they intensified trade, so different regions could specialize in what they did best. But above all, these increasing numbers of people brought new land under cultivation. The issue with that last bit is that this new land wasn't necessarily all that fertile. Once the rising population got through the good land, the stuff that could be easily cleared and put to use, they were left with rocky hillsides, marshes near the coast, and low-lying land that was really vulnerable to flooding. Now, this wasn't especially productive farmland, but to feed everybody, it had to be planted with grain. Even then, there was barely enough food to go around. So we're talking about an incredibly tight land market crowded with a ton of extremely poor people who had enough to eat only if they were lucky. When the climate worsened, as with the Great Famine of 1315 to 1317, the results were disastrous. Any disruption to the normal production of food meant that a whole lot of folks were going to starve. The same was true of the Black Death. You can't just take half the farm laborers and expect there to be no disruption to agriculture. A lot of those poor, landless folks right on the edge of survival probably died not from the plague, but from hunger or related issues. The grand result was a death toll of at least 50% and probably 60%. Now, normally, in the aftermath of a major mortality event, population rebounds pretty quickly. Think the baby boom. There are more resources to go around, survivors have more children, and so on. Within a generation or two, population bounces back. But that didn't happen here for a few different reasons. The sheer scale of the pandemic took out an enormous chunk of the population. Life expectancies were already incredibly low by our standards. Somebody born in, say, 1280 had a life expectancy at birth of around 25. Infant mortality and adolescent death rates were incredibly high. That means that it took really favorable conditions over a long period of time to produce sustained population growth. Good weather, stable harvests, things like that. Those conditions were not present after the Black Death. There are two basic components to demography: fertility and mortality. Birth rates were exceptionally high across the pre-modern period. Fertility didn't really change all that much. The question was how much mortality varied and what effect that had. Mortality was already high after the Black Death. Remember, life expectancy at birth, maybe 25. That got way worse afterward. The weather was bad. Harvests were irregular for a long time. War raged across France, Spain, and Italy, which caused further misery. Most of all, the plague didn't go away. It came back again and again and again. There was a big resurgence between 1360 and 1363 that was especially hard on children born since the Black Death. There were scattered outbreaks afterward, too, if that all weren't enough. The end result of all this was a substantial increase in mortality that made it very difficult for the population to grow. Fertility couldn't rise enough to do anything other than keep the population constant. If the average woman was already giving birth to between 6 and 8 children over the course of her lifetime, with maybe 2 or 3 surviving to adulthood, there wasn't a lot of slack there. So for the next 150 years or so, Europe's population would remain basically flat. If that average life expectancy in 1280 was about 25, it was more like 20 for someone born in 1350. This period of stagnant, low population lasted longer in some places than in others. England had around 6 million people before the Black Death. Afterward, the population hovered between 2 and 2.5 million until about 1525. It bounced back a bit faster in other places, like Italy, where the population rose after about 1450 or so. So, how do we know all this? How can we tell that the population dropped off? Well, we have a few different ways. First, we have the same kinds of tax records that we talked about on last week's episode. Pretty unanimously, they tell us that there were fewer people at every point after the Black Death than there had been beforehand. Villages that survived had fewer people. Plenty of settlements just completely ceased to exist. Either the population died or they immigrated to other places. Pottery tells us pretty much the same story. A really smart investigation by an archaeologist named Carenza Lewis looked at the amount of pottery that shows up in rural English sites from this period on both sides of the Black Death. After the Black Death, there was no question. The pottery-using population was about 45% lower than it had been before. This means that even where we don't have those tax records or other direct indicators of population, we can still see a steep drop-off. Lewis's estimate doesn't include whole villages that were depopulated either, or people so poor that they weren't using pottery at all. No matter what source base we use, it tells the same story. Whole swaths of the countryside that had been densely populated were now almost devoid of people. This is a basic fact that we have to understand if we want to grasp what the world was like after the Black Death. There were a lot fewer people in Europe. In effect, the survivors of the Black Death and their descendants lived through a demographic transition. This has tons of implications, especially for the economy. Fewer people meant tighter labor markets, but also less demand for goods and services. Land went from being a precious, rare commodity to a plentiful one. Instead of just growing grain to feed that huge number of people, growers could diversify with many different products. Mass death also meant a huge transfer of resources in the form of inheritance. And those are just the immediate consequences. On a really foundational level, medieval society was built on the control of land, landed resources, and the people who lived and worked on that land. When the Black Death killed 50 or 60% of the population, it altered that foundation in really fundamental ways. It changed the economy. It changed the top-down power relations that bound society together. It changed politics and social structures. It changed families. It changed how people thought about death and God. But that's all kind of abstract. It's time for us to meet some people who can help us understand what all that meant in human terms. We're going to rural Essex in the eastern part of England, to a large village called Great Waltham. There's a family living there, the Holmans, who are going to be our guide to this post-plague world. I'm drawing here on the work of a historian named L.R. Pooz in a book called A Rural Society After the Black Death, Essex, 1350 to 1525. I've based the Holmans loosely on some real people found in records around that time. So let's meet the Holmans. In 1348, on the eve of the Black Death's arrival, the Holmans are on the low end of the socioeconomic spectrum in Great Waltham. Somewhere around 800 people live in this village. That makes it a pretty large one, almost a town by the standards of the time. Great Waltham's inhabitants aren't free to do as they please, though. The entire village belongs to a manor, a subdivision of territory that belongs to a lord. In this case, the lord is the Earl of Essex, a guy named Humphrey de Bohun. Humphrey's a pretty warlike guy. In 1348, he's well known as a captain serving in Edward III's army in France. Great Waltham is just one of the many, many manors this great and powerful lord owns. The Holmans have never seen Humphrey de Bohun. Aside from taking some pride over English victories over the French that they hear about from travelers, they aren't especially concerned with what the high and mighty are doing with their time. The Holmans' major concern is survival. Now, they're on the low end of the socioeconomic spectrum, but they're still better off than a lot of people in Great Waltham. They hold some good farmland, they own a couple of pigs and a few cows. That's enough to keep the whole family fed, but not comfortably. Lean harvest years, like the last few, due to just some terrible weather, mean a lot of stretching to make it through the winter without starving. The Holman family has two aging adults and four grown children. Three other children didn't survive to adulthood. Cecilia Holman is the family matriarch. She's 45 years old in 1348. In addition to the frankly enormous amount of household work that Cecilia does, cooking, cleaning, things like that, she also brews ale in a couple of 12-gallon vats in an outbuilding behind their tiny three-room thatched cottage. Her family drinks most of the ale. It's a staple, but she sells some of it for extra cash. That money comes in handy for paying their rent, their taxes, and the occasional fine. It also allows them to make the occasional cash purchase in Great Waltham or the nearby market town of Chelmsford. Cecilia's husband, Old John, is around 50. He spends most of his time going out into their few acres of land, which are planted with wheat. At his age, with years of hard labor already weighing down his bones, it's getting harder and harder for Old John to do that work. Their older son, Young John, is 25. He helps his father out in the fields and handles most of the care of the animals, which they graze on the village's common pasture land. Their elder daughter, Matilda, is 23. She's married to a local man and lives nearby. Her life is much like her mother's. The Holmans also have two younger children, teenaged Peter and Eleanor. Both work as hired hands, Peter as an unskilled farm laborer and Eleanor as a servant in the Lord's manor house. The Holmans have a decent setup, but they aren't free. They're serfs. This means that in addition to rent on their land, they owe their lord labor service for a specified number of days every year. More precisely, they owe that labor service to the agents running the manor that Humphrey de Bohun never visits. As serfs, the Holmans can't marry or leave without their lord's permission. The free and unfree alike in Great Waltham have to go through the lord's court, the manor court, when they want to right some wrong. For that privilege, the lord collects a nice, tidy little fee for every transaction. This is the basic shape of the Holman's life. Close to the edge of subsistence, but at least they have a lease on some land. They're not just laborers. A lot of their neighbors are crowded into filthy one-room shacks. The Holmans have three rooms. Cecilia's brewing brings in some ready cash, if not that much of it. Young John will inherit the lease. Matilda, the elder daughter, made a good marriage. Their younger daughter, Eleanor, will too. Peter's a big, strapping lad. He's hoping to get good enough with a longbow that he can sign on for one of King Edward's campaigns in France. So, with all this in mind, there's some small reason for hope amid the grinding, tenuous, day-to-day reality of the Holman's existence. The harvest comes around in the autumn of 1348. Old John's arthritis and bad back are troubling him as he and Young John harvest the grain out in their fields. Cecilia is finishing up a fresh batch of ale. They, and all the other inhabitants of Great Waltham, have no idea that doom is approaching. Just 45 miles away in London, the Black Death is already raging.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
The Black Death tears through Great Waltham just weeks after news of it first reaches the village from London. It makes its first appearance among the farmers who sell their excess grain in Chelmsford, that good-sized market town about 6 miles away from the village. From there, it reaches their families, and within a few weeks, it's everywhere. Dozens die. At first, they're buried in individual graves. But soon, there are just too many bodies for that. The survivors open up a trench in the churchyard and carefully stack the corpses one on top of another. The Holmans suffer along with their friends and neighbors. Old John wakes up feeling fine in the morning, and he's dead by evening. An infected flea bit him directly on a vein, and the septicemic plague that follows is 100% fatal. Matilda catches the bubonic version and dies several agonizing days after the swellings appear in her neck and armpit. So does her husband. Cecilia, too, is infected, but she manages to fight off the disease after hovering near death for several days. The other children, Peter, young John, and Eleanor, they all survive. The plague burns itself out as the freezing winter weather arrives in December. Half of the inhabitants of Great Waltham have died in the past several months, especially among the poorest and the most vulnerable. Those landless, penniless laborers who were living so close to the demographic edge have suffered disproportionately. By contrast, the Holmans have gotten relatively lucky. The family that farmed the few acres next to their land was completely wiped out. Many of the other leaseholders in their village who held land from Lord Humphrey de Bohun have likewise died. In the immediate aftermath of the plague, there's a surprising amount of stability in Great Waltham. Leases on the best land are quickly distributed. Young John picks up those few acres next to their land in addition to the lease they already hold. Some of the landless wage laborers acquire leases of their own for the first time. The De Bohun's local agents simply can't find anybody to take on leases on the worst land, those rocky hillsides and swampy lowlands. For the first time in living memory, land isn't an incredibly scarce commodity. When harvest time rolls around in 1349, there aren't as many of those landless laborers who depend on wage work. This means that the price of labor goes up. When young John wants to hire a man to help them with the harvest on this newly enlarged piece of land, it costs more, much more than it had in the past. Luckily, his younger brother Peter is available for work. The harvest of 1349 is one of the worst in years. It's a near complete failure. But grain prices rise because of that terrible harvest. The brothers manage to squirrel away a tiny little profit. Cecilia is back to brewing after recovering from the plague. The price of her ale has risen too. Eleanor's wages as a household servant in the manor house have likewise gone up. Deaths in the extended family, including Matilda and her husband, have left them 5 cows and 12 pigs to add to their collection of livestock. The family still does their days of required labor for the De Bohuns, remember, they're serfs, but they grumble about it a little more than usual. Why should they work for the Lord when they can make more profit working their own land? Those kinds of complaints, those little grumbles, are growing more common in Great Waltham after the plague. This was the general pattern for several years after the Black Death. The prices of commodities and labor varied more, and they were more sensitive to change than they'd been before the plague. The general pattern was pretty good for people like the Holmans. So let's take a step back here. The Black Death had an enormous effect on the economy of medieval Europe. There was both a supply-side shock and a demand-side shock. There was a supply-side shock to the labor market, since there were so many fewer people available to do work. There was a demand-side shock to the economy, since there were so many fewer people consuming goods. These were the baseline things that affected millions of people like the Holmans in profound ways. Less available labor meant higher wages across the board. Less demand meant less production, but the price of what was available rose, and demand didn't fall nearly as much as supply did. So many people dying meant a lot of inheritance, with greater resources like land, livestock, movable wealth coming into fewer hands. All of this was good news for people like the Holmans. Mass death also drastically reduced the overall demand for land. Remember, land was the fundamental thing on which the European economy and its society were based. People had been packed in like sardines in villages like Great Waltham. Every scrap of available land was leased out at exorbitant rates. Lords could demand high rents. They could enforce harsh terms of labor service, those days of required work every year for unfree serfs. The upshot is that the Black Death strengthened the position of ordinary folk like the Holmans. Their land was less expensive, and if they were enterprising and lucky, they could expand their holdings. The goods they produced were worth more. Their labor was worth more. Their small inheritance from dead relatives, just a few coins and some cattle, maybe a lease on some good land, well, all that went a long way. Lords, by contrast, got the worst end of this deal. They had to pay more for labor. Their land wasn't worth as much in rents. The dues and tolls they collected on the use of mills and bridges went down, with fewer people using them. For a few years, markets didn't operate as efficiently. There were fewer trade fairs and other venues to exchange goods. This was bad for pretty much everybody. But it changed fast. New markets and new patterns of demand cropped up. Far from slipping backward into subsistence, with higher wages and a higher standard of living, the economy got more commercialized. Really, considering how many millions of people had just died, things went about as smoothly as possible. These were the basic dynamics that drove the economy after the Black Death, the conditions that people like the Holmans experienced. As these dynamics emerged, the people who were most hurt by them, the rich and the powerful, tried taking steps to minimize their losses. The clearest example of this is the Statute of Laborers, a law passed by the English Parliament in 1351. The statute set a maximum wage based on what had been paid in 1346. It also prevented laborers from leaving to seek better wages elsewhere, and it forced able-bodied people to work. This was a straightforward sop to lords and other well-off people, exactly the folks who were in the business of hiring others to work for wages. Most importantly, it didn't work. Enforcing the statute was basically impossible and rarely ever tried. Except in the case of one John Holman of Waltham. A real person named John Holman of Great Waltham, the basis for our friend Young John, was actually fined heavily in 1352 by royal justices for breaching the Statute of Laborers. Let's try to understand how this might have come about. So, a few years now after the Black Death, the Holmans are prospering. Cecilia has expanded her ale brewing, which Young John and her daughter Eleanor both help with. Cecilia has found spouses for both Young John and Eleanor. Good matches. Seems like everybody in Waltham is getting married after the plague. Eleanor is no longer working as a servant, but the money she saved from her higher wages after the plague give her a good nest egg for acquiring a lease on some land and brewing equipment. Peter has made good on his practice with the longbow and done his first stint on campaign in France, where an English army captured the city of Calais. Young John has acquired another parcel of land adjacent to what they already own. He's also bought a bunch more pigs to add to their existing herd. For whatever reason, it's not exactly clear why, survivors of the Black Death developed quite a taste for pork. Where the prices of other animals fluctuated pretty wildly, the price of pigs and pig products stayed high all the time. So, Young John decides that he's going to go along with this. He adds butchery as a lucrative side business. This is where the trouble with the Statute of Laborers comes in. John Holman and his family are taking advantage of the economic climate after the Black Death. Because land is cheap and available, and because inheritance concentrated wealth among the survivors, people in and around Great Waltham have more money to spend. That means more to spend on relative luxuries like ale and pork. Demand for both of those products is sky high, and per capita consumption of them has rocketed upwards. For folks like the Holmans, who already have a foothold in these industries, that adds up to an opportunity to expand the business. So, John's butcher side business is going well. He's not only selling his own pork products, but providing that butchery service to others in Great Waltham as well. He knows there's a maximum wage set by the Statute of Laborers, but like everybody else, he ignores it. As you'd expect with far fewer people in the workforce, the price of labor is higher, much higher. That's just basic economics. It's a fundamental market force. Unfortunately for John, he gets caught on the wrong side of that. Maybe he's made an enemy of the local bailiff or the parish priest, or maybe he tried to overcharge a monastery that has some royal connections. Anyway, John finds himself hauled in front of the royal justices who occasionally make their way through Great Waltham. He's fined heavily for breaching the statute of laborers. If that weren't enough, we know that John also got fined again shortly thereafter for trying to dodge some taxes, the assize of ale on the ale that Cecilia brews. That's just a local offense rather than a royal one, but the fine is still a pain. John must have really made somebody mad here. The statute of laborers was a failure, and folks were constantly getting fined for trying to skip out on little taxes like the assize of ale. In the case of the Holmans, we should see these things as evidence of them moving up in the world. The conditions of their lives were improving. Young John never would have run afoul of the statute if he weren't in a position to demand more pay for his services as a butcher. Cecilia wouldn't have been dodging taxes on her ale if she weren't making enough surplus to sell it in quantities. Like millions of other people across Europe, the Holmans were beginning to take advantage of the new conditions the plague had created. But they were also building on shifts that had already started to take place over the prior couple of centuries. In their emphasis on producing goods to sell on the open market, for example, the Holmans were carrying on the legacy of the commercial revolution between 1100 and 1300 or so. The plague accelerated that shift. This comes back to something I mentioned earlier. The plague was both the root cause of new developments and a catalyst for things that were already happening. In both cases, the upshot was simple for people like the Holmans. For now, at least for now, things were looking up.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths, and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
For the Holmans, these fine conditions last for most of the 1350s. Young John, not so young anymore, acquires the lease on another parcel of land to add to their growing acreage. Eleanor works closely on the brewing business with Cecilia, and the daughter and her husband use their share of the profits to acquire some land to add to their own plot. Peter continues as a soldier and goes on campaign to France in 1356 with the Black Prince, the son of King Edward. He makes a fortune in plunder as they ravage the French countryside. Even better, Peter captures a wealthy French knight during the Battle of Poitiers, which brings a large ransom. We'll come back to Peter's military adventures in a little while. With that ready cash in hand, Peter outright acquires land, not just a lease on it. He owes no feudal service for it and no rent. Labor is expensive, but Peter makes enough to hire hands to work for him while he's on campaign. The Holmans are still serfs. So are most of their neighbors. Peter's ransom money allows him to buy his way out of it, but most folks just don't bother. Fewer of them are bothering to show up for their required days of service on the Lord's land every year. Those who do skip days or they loaf around. The De Bohun's local agents don't really have the means to compel the serfs to do more. That means hiring laborers to do the work for pay instead of having serfs do it as a feudal obligation. All of this costs the big landowners money. Lords tried to adapt to these new conditions. One recent study by a scholar named Martin Stevenson suggests that in a time of increased costs, most landlords tried to solve the problem of decreasing returns by increasing their capital investments in their land. They built mills, they built fish weirs, they built bridges, anything that would increase the value of their property. This is fascinating because it's good evidence that medieval landowners were rational economic agents in the way that we'd understand it. They understood the risk of capital investment and they were willing to take that risk in order to gain higher returns. That was especially salient in a time when lords' revenues were falling after the plague. These new dynamics also created new tensions between lords and common folk. Lords, as they'd always done, tried to compel their serfs to show up for work. Serfs refused, or they engaged in small-scale acts of resistance, like tearing up a fence or letting loose some of the lord's livestock. These tensions would boil over in various places after the plague, with greater and lesser violence. To be clear, revolts and uprisings were always fairly common in medieval Europe. There were major revolts in Sicily in 1282. It's called the Sicilian Vespers, and in Flanders in 1302. In the latter case, Flemish townspeople slaughtered a whole bunch of French knights in a major battle. Those were just two among many, many, many others. In fact, the great medieval historian Mark Bloch once said that uprisings were more or less the natural state of the medieval world. But the scale, frequency, and character of those revolts changed dramatically after the Black Death. In France, the Jacquerie of 1358, a peasants' revolt, was shockingly violent. There was a huge uprising in England in 1381, and there was another in 1450. Those are just the best-known ones. The historian Samuel Cohn wrote a really good book about revolts in late medieval Europe called Lust for Liberty. Cohn exhaustively searches through chronicles and archival records on both sides of the Black Death. Sure enough, he finds exactly what we'd expect. Those changed conditions after the plague really did lead to more uprisings, more revolts, more rebellions, and other kinds of disturbances too. The kinds of issues we pointed to with the Holmans, like anger at the Lord's demand for labor services, touched off peasant revolts everywhere from the countryside around Florence to the countryside in England. Towns and cities had plenty of unrest of their own, too. Artisans and laborers weren't shy about expressing their discontent, either with their economic situation or with the politics of their local community. All across Europe, ordinary folks were growing bolder and bolder about giving voice to their legitimate complaints and then acting on them. Cohn sums this up beautifully, quote, "From utter despondency in the wake of Europe's most monumental mortality, peasants, workers, artisans, and petty shopkeepers became emboldened with a new self and class confidence. After the Black Death, both north and south of the Alps, they organized collectively, and with increased frequency they revolted to change the here and now, to gain liberty, to preserve their dignity, and to expand their rights and those of their communities." We're going to talk a lot more about those revolts in a couple of months. For now, it's enough to say that the Black Death had a lot to do with these dynamics. Medieval society was always hierarchical. It was always dominated by elites. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't room to fight about what those relationships were supposed to look like. The Black Death and its consequences opened up a lot of space for those kinds of fights. Not all of those fights were big clashes. Common folk challenged their social hierarchies, the idea that they were destined to a low spot on the totem pole and that this was good and right in all sorts of ways. With more material resources and fewer inhibitions after the plague, peasants and townspeople found ways of fomenting small, daily rebellions. Here's a disapproving quotation from a Florentine chronicler named Matteo Villani. Quote, "The common people, by reason of the abundance and superfluity that they found, would no longer work at their accustomed trades. They wanted the dearest and most delicate foods, while children and common women clad themselves in the fair and costly garments of the illustrious who had died." Villani is horrified here by what he sees as common people's violations of the normal social order. Idleness when they should be working, eating fancy food instead of plain bread and whatnot, wearing fancy clothes rather than plain ones. For Villani, all of these acts were a threat to the established social order, a social order that needed to be maintained. The Black Death gave the people pushing against that order both the means and the boldness to do the pushing. So the Black Death changed the fundamentals of the economy and it altered the social fabric. It also changed mentalities, especially around religion and death. Religiosity had already been on the rise for a couple of centuries, but the Black Death accelerated that process. We talked about books of hours and private devotion in past episodes. Those phenomena really only came about after the Black Death on a large scale. Another example of this increased religiosity is naming practices. Christian names, Peter, David, Paul, things like that, became more common after the plague. The best explanation is that the Christian name was supposed to give the child a spiritual patron to ward off the mortality. Patterns of pious donations shifted with the Black Death, too. Medieval people had always given freely to religious organizations, especially in their wills, but not always in the same way. In cities like Siena, Pisa, and Florence in Italy, for example, wills increasingly specified that donations would be used to create religious art to remember the deceased person. A painted altarpiece was supposed to contain an exact likeness of the person who donated for it. The old practice, by contrast, had been a general donation to a religious institution. According to Samuel Cohn, this reflected a shift in mentality toward the glorification of the individual. The here and now was the focus, not really eternity. This conception of the individual is intimately bound up with the Renaissance. It's conceivable that we have the plague to thank for that, at least in Italy. Now, all of this makes sense. After the plague, death was an inescapable fact of existence in a way it hadn't been before. Today, tomorrow, next week, next year, any person could be struck down by a disease that nobody really understood and which nobody could predict or prevent. It's only natural that mentalities changed to match that new state of affairs. This meant putting death front and center in people's lives. In artistic depictions, death becomes a ravening monster. Churches were decorated with terrifying depictions of hell and graphic depictions of the tortures that awaited the sinful after death. Maybe the local parish church in Great Waltham received a new decoration of this kind in the 1350s. Maybe an up-and-coming family like the Holmans paid for it out of their new profits. The fate of their souls is always in the back of their minds. No matter how prosperous they might become, no matter how many little children might run through Cecilia's brewery and young John's butcher shop and their growing fields, death is always lurking just around the corner. By the late 1350s, the Holmans have officially moved up in the world. Cecilia is now the biggest brewer of ale in Great Waltham, and she's driven her small-scale competitors out of business. Young John's butcher shop is thriving, and he's acquired another parcel of land. Eleanor and her husband have opened up a second brewery of their own under Cecilia's watchful eye. A passel of grandchildren have joined the family. Now, Peter owns land outright in Great Waltham. He's the only one of the family to do so, and he's the only one technically free from serfdom. He's essentially a soldier by trade. He's a skilled longbowman who works for pay on contract, and he spent most of the second half of the 1350s on campaign in France. I mentioned the Battle of Poitiers earlier. It was perhaps the most crushing English victory of the Hundred Years' War. The French king was taken captive, and so was much of the flower of the French nobility. The ransom payments alone were a crushing burden on France, not to mention the loss of much of the political elite. But while Peter Holman made a small fortune on ransom in the aftermath of the battle, that's not the most important thing to bear in mind. Pitched battles were only a tiny portion of what the Hundred Years' War actually involved. Most of Peter's time in France was spent burning villages and destroying crops. He besieged castles and blockaded trade routes. He and his comrades stole livestock and plundered manor houses. He sacked towns and robbed merchant caravans. There's a term for these destructive expeditions, chevauchée. War is misery, not glory. Peter and his comrades inflicted a great deal of it on French villagers who had never held a weapon. At least Peter and the English armies were subject to official truces and peace treaties. Peter has land, and when the war is over, he goes back to Great Waltham, to his home and family. Other unemployed soldiers stuck around and formed what amounted to huge bands of robbers, the Free Companies. For the afflicted French peasantry, the end result was pretty much the same. Now, it's not like war had been uncommon prior to the 1340s. From crusades with multiple kings to petty lords feuding over possession of a village, organized violence was hardly rare in the High Middle Ages. But in the mid-1340s, things took a turn. We know about the English in France, but Genoa and Venice fought a series of nasty, destructive wars. The Mamluks completed their takeover of the Near East. The Ottoman Turks were rising in Asia Minor. The Mongols of the Golden Horde were besieging Kaffa, as we know. And there were innumerable other conflicts, large and small. There were succession wars in Castile and expensive conflicts between Italian city-states. All of these wars made long-distance trade more difficult, especially that immensely profitable and important trade between Asia and Europe. The loss of that trade would eventually help to drive Europeans toward the Atlantic and into the Age of Discovery. But on a much smaller scale, the depredations of men like Peter played a role that was every bit as important in defining the post-plague world. They disrupted the normal function of the economy on a local and regional scale. They stole and burned and murdered and generally made life miserable for the regular people of the towns and countryside. These kinds of everyday miseries grew more common in the late 14th and 15th centuries. While Peter and thousands of other sturdy English lads are burning their way through French villages, life in Great Waltham is settling back into something like normalcy. By 1360, the outlines of the new status quo are becoming clear. Fewer people, higher wages, and a higher standard of living for ordinary folks. But that sense of normalcy is an illusion. In 1361, the plague returns. Cecilia has spent the night with a friend in Chelmsford, 6 miles away from Great Waltham. She's selling a consignment of ale there. By noon the next day, when she returns home, she's coughing blood. By evening, she's dead. Within a week, so is her daughter Eleanor. Eleanor is pregnant at the time, and the plague is especially lethal for pregnant women. Two of Cecilia's 5 grandchildren follow her and Eleanor into the grave. This second recurrence of bubonic plague is often called the children's plague, since so many of its victims were the children and adolescents born between 1348 and 1360. Whether it was particularly lethal for them or just seemed so is up for debate. What's important is that this second pandemic, and it went pretty much everywhere the first one did, cemented the new state of affairs for good. The Black Death was so lethal that the population would have needed a long time to recover regardless. But the children's plague showed that the disease was here to stay. It would come back again and again and again over the next 400 years. Young John, Peter, and a clutch of their children, nieces, and nephews survived the second plague recurrence. Life goes on in Great Waltham, just as it had after the Black Death a dozen years before. But this is a new world. Disease was the primary cause of that much higher mortality that kept the population low. The climate has passed the tipping point from the medieval climate anomaly to something much less friendly. The 1350s were one of the coldest decades of the last millennium, with little sun and brutal winters. War spared the Holmans in Great Waltham, but not other stretches of Europe. The Holmans did their best in this changed world and made the most of the opportunities that it presented to the survivors. When there were chances to thrive, folks like the Holmans made the most of them. When the weather turned good again for a few decades at the end of the 14th century, grain prices rose, harvests were outstanding. The Holmans, now the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Cecilia and old John, made fine profits and they expanded their landholdings. They became respectable yeomen. When the weather massively deteriorated into the Arctic cold of the Little Ice Age after around 1420, those same enterprising folks switched from grain to pasturing livestock, especially sheep. One simple marker of how much better life could be for the survivors is diet. The historian Christopher Dyer analyzed dietary patterns before and after the plague. He estimated that in 1256, a harvest worker got 75% of his calories from bread and just 2.5% from meat. In 1424, that same worker would get 20% of his calories from meat and just 37.5% from bread. Fish, fruit, beans, rice, and booze took up the rest of that total. Which diet would you rather eat? With higher wages, higher prices, a higher standard of living, and more available land, the Holmans' descendants could nimbly react to changing circumstances. Maybe they continued the family business and put together the capital to build an industrial-scale brewing operation. Those became more common in the 15th century. Perhaps they kept moving up the scale of social respectability and acquired even more land. Maybe they married into the local minor nobility. On the other hand, though, maybe a new wave of plague or a series of awful harvests caught up with them as well. This is the paradox of the Black Death in particular and the Great Transition in general. Tens of millions of people died in the plague. Millions more would perish when it came back again and again. The changing climate and the awful harvests it produced left huge segments of the population starving and malnourished. War killed large numbers of people and immiserated even more. And yet, the survivors were left with opportunities their forebears could never have imagined. Even the worst depths of the post-plague world, a deep economic recession, a series of cold snaps in the climate, more disease outbreaks, and terrible wars in the mid-15th century, even then, the groundwork was being laid for the world that came after. Those worst years gave us voyages of exploration. They gave us the printing press. They gave us the seeds of increasing piety that would eventually produce the Reformation. They gave us the widespread adoption of gunpowder. They gave us the dynastic acquisitions that created modern states. That economic recession was based around a shortage of bullion and available capital. That gave us more efficient ways of pooling and using resources to create profit, which underlies a lot of those other things. Whether all of this is good or bad is kind of irrelevant. The fact is, they're all a product of the world of the Great Transition. And the Black Death was the key turning point that gave us that transition. Next time on Tides of History, we'll talk about something we touched on here today, the Hundred Years War. How could a war last a century? Over the course of two episodes, we're going to find out. Until then, though, thank you for joining me here on Tides. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA. You can follow the show on either at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Jeff Schmidt. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. The producer is Leah Sutherland. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.